Hi, this is Mimi Sheraton, author of A Thousand Foods to Eat Before You Die, and you are listening to Radio Cherry Bomb.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to Radio Cherry Bomb. I'm Carrie Diamond, editorial director of Cherry Bomb, the indie magazine about women and food. This season of Radio Cherry Bomb is brought to you by Knopf, publisher of food's most fabulous icons, from Julia Child to Lydia Bastianich, and home to new literary talents, such as Sweet Bitter's Stephanie Dandler. Today's show is a tough one. It's our post-election show, and it's not the show we thought we'd be doing. Chances are, if you are a Cherry Bomb reader or a Radio Cherry Bomb listener, you were a Hillary supporter. You were excited about the prospect of the first female president of the United States, and you looked forward to the shattering of the ultimate glass ceiling. But none of this was meant to be. It's really hard for me to read these words right now. But none of this was meant to be. Instead, we wound up with a president-elect whose attitudes toward women are pretty vile. Tuesday night was unbearable, and yesterday, Wednesday, was a dark, dark day. I have to send a special thank you to the server at Barbuda who poured me rosé for several hours yesterday. Thank you for that. Because we're not the types to sit around and mope, we have four women here today to talk about what the heck happened, what this means, and what we can do moving forward. I'd like to welcome Erin McKenna, founder of Erin McKenna's Bakery, formerly known as Baby Cakes. Charlotte Druckman, author of the book Skirt Steak. Oh, you know what? You should say hi so everybody knows whose voice
is. Oh, hi. This is Erin. I'm the one with the cold.
Erin has a little cold. Charlotte Druckman, author of the book Skirt Steak, Women Chefs on Standing the Heat and Staying in the Kitchen.
Hi.
Thanks for being here, Charlotte. And Jessamine Rodriguez, the founder of Hot Bread Kitchen.
Hi.
And on the phone is Marion Nessel, the NYU professor and food policy expert.
Hi. Glad to be here even by phone.
Hi, Marion. Thank you. So did any of you think Donald Trump would win?
I did.
You did.
Mary.
You
the,
did.
The smart one.
But why?
Yeah, no.
Why
I
didn't
mean,
you call
I,
us?
What happened once, I was in Washington, D.C., and I was with a friend from New Zealand who was asking everybody she knew who they were going to vote for. And we took a cab ride with an African-American cab driver, and he said he was voting for Trump. And she asked why, and he said, because I want change. And I thought, if this guy is voting for Trump, Trump's going to win.
Wow. How about the rest of you?
No, but I was in Cuba last week, and people asked me if I thought it was possible he could win, and I laughed and said, oh, no, of course not. I mean, I thought about it, but I also just didn't think that things had gotten that bad that we could, as a country, actually elect Donald Trump. And I'm glad I'm not in Cuba anymore so that they can't laugh at me.
I felt like the only glimmer that I got was when Brexit happened. And there was a couple days there where I was like, yeah, this could happen here. But I feel like we allowed ourselves to be so misled by the polls, you know, and it was the story we wanted to believe. And so I didn't really revisit it as a real likelihood until about 1 a.m.
I didn't
Tuesday night.
Embarrassingly, I mean, I was sick, and so I didn't even watch that night. I was like, it's in the bag. Good night. And so when I opened up the news, you know, 5 a.m. on Wednesday, I was shocked. I was like, why is Donald Trump's face everywhere? Why is his face everywhere? Like, that was my first thought. Deep down, I think all of us kind of knew he was trying to get the voters who had, you know, just lost hope and hadn't voted ever or had stopped voting or caring. And I think he really played to them and he brought them out and he was, you know, saying these radical things, kind of speaking to their collective id. And it just worked. Like, it was so out there that it actually got people riled up and thinking that, you know, this is a good idea and this guy's going to do this stuff for us.
I knew he was going to win the nomination. I never thought in 1 million years he would be elected president. I thought Hillary would win in a landslide. Yeah. It was so agonizing watching on Tuesday night. I went to bed early because I had a
call time, a very early call time the next day. And I went to bed thinking, okay, it'll be close, but I'll wake up and Hillary will be president. And I woke up at 6 o'clock and I looked at my phone and I just couldn't believe what I saw. And girlfriends had already started texting at 6 o'clock and I called one of them and I couldn't even speak.
Yeah.
I couldn't even form a sentence. I was so shocked.
I had to unfortunately take my dog into the emergency vet on Tuesday night at midnight, and I'd never had to do that before. And so it was at exactly the same time that Hillary was sort of the reality that she might lose was beginning to hit. And I had deliberately turned off my TV because I just didn't want to hear it. I was listening to Miles Davis. I was editing some recipes, and then my dog had this back spasm. And I had to go to the vet, and there was the news. I was the only person in the waiting room, and it was me and NBC and her losing Pennsylvania. And I was just like, oh my God. And I have to say, the thing that's really been sitting with me is, I mean, it's pretty somber, but we're really dealing with issues of race, honestly, and sexism in this country. And if you go back and look at how people voted and what that story is, I mean, that's kind of, that's the news, or it was news to me. Not to say that I didn't know that we had these problems in our country, but, you know, when you see how many women didn't vote for Hillary and you just see how things shook out, it's really disturbing. And yeah, I realize I was possibly naive about that.
Marian, did you watch the results?
Oh, I watched it for as long as I could stand it. And, you know, I was hoping, like everybody else, that it would go a different way. But I knew by 10 o'clock, like if I was watching the New York Times, the New York Times had adorable technology with all these different graphs and charts. I love stuff like that. And I was watching those, and it was clear by 10 o'clock that it was going to go to Trump.
I was still holding on hope around 11. Yeah.
Me too.
Yeah. I didn't want to believe what I was seeing, I guess. And you could even tell the people on television couldn't believe what they were seeing. It was very interesting. I was watching PBS, and I think it was David Brooks. I think David Brooks was in shock.
Yeah.
I can't imagine what it was like the rest of the night, and I'm kind of glad I didn't
just
see it.
Staring at Wayne County and Philadelphia's, you know, just hoping that enough votes would, you know, pushing all optimism in that direction, but knowing in our hearts that weren't going to make it. It was surreal.
But back to what Charlotte said about the sexism and the racism, I mean, I really think that's what it all boils down to. And I know that might be kind of simplistic. They're talking, the big thing now is that he was the change candidate, and that's why he won. But I don't know. He's surrounding himself by Chris Christie, Newt Gingrich, and Rudy Giuliani. How does that represent change?
I mean, for me, I think sexism and racism are part of it. But for me, in the lens that I bring to the work that I do, even though it's a gender lens, is really around economic inequality. Mm-hmm. And I think that it was as much a response to that, and to not include that, and obviously that has, you know, it's a powerful intersection with race and gender, but I think the economic inequality in this country is what ultimately, and our inability to respond to it, is what have led us to this for me.
Marian?
Well, we live in a racist, sexist society, and what was so shocking, I think, to so many of us is to realize that 58 million people share those views. Mm-hmm. And for those of us who don't and live in a New York bubble, where most people are, where people are diverse and most people tolerate it pretty well, it's pretty shocking. And I think what worries me about it so much is that what has been unleashed is kind of a tacit social approval of these kinds of opinions. One of the reasons I think that the polls were so off was because people lie when they come out of the polls. They know they hold attitudes that are not particularly politically correct, and they don't tell people what they think they want to hear. So I never believe polls. And that was another reason why I was pretty convinced he was going to win. If African-American cab drivers in Washington are going to vote for Trump, he's got a much, much wider reach than most people understand. And, you know, I asked that cab driver, what kind of change do you think this change is going to be good for you? And he said it didn't really matter. That it was, he just wanted change. Well, he's going to get it.
Yeah.
And you have to be careful what you ask for.
I think what the really unique and, I don't know, I don't want to say exciting, but like the opportunity here is, it's this whole election, it's like a pimple coming to the surface. And now we're forced to look at what the issues are. And all of this, a lot of people are being inspired to be active in the change that is to come. And whereas, like, you know, if things are kind of moving along normally, everyone just kind of turns away. But now everyone's getting involved. People are excited. They're inspired. And I think it's a good moment for us to kind of dive in and
I hear you, but I feel like a lot of us felt that way anyway.
Before, right.
Now,
but I think it's even wider. I feel like it's reaching people who otherwise would just be sitting at home and not kind of ignoring the problems.
I actually think it's necessary now. Like, I think in a way that is aggressive. I think it is aggressively necessary now if you have a belief in equality and justice, and you do not want to see whatever the gap is, whether it's socioeconomic or it's race or it's gender. I think you now, as a person who lives in a democracy that does not appear to be working, if you want it to work, it is your job to step up.
Right.
Because I agree with that pimple thing, but it's really also that pendulum swing where we had 8 years of having relatively progressive change or an attempt to have it, and we had an African-American president. And a lot of the response that we saw on Tuesday was years of people actually being that hateful and annoyed that we had an African-American president. So it's not just that I think that we can take whatever hope and good feelings that we have. I think we have to, because I think that Trump actually, it's almost like activating terrorist cells. He activated these pockets of hate that I honestly just thought were outlier phenomena. They're not.
I think it's also that he activated pockets of poverty in places where 8 years ago there weren't such endemic pockets of poverty, right? Like the Rust Belt, I think, 8 years ago, we were like, oh, you know, it can be saved. That, you know, the progressive policy, union work will maybe bring more jobs and better jobs into those areas. And 8 years later, those people are older, less employable, and in cities and rural areas where there's just not jobs coming back. And I think that is really, for me, that's what I see as the heart of it.
Jessamine, can you talk about the work you do at Hot Bread Kitchen? Because I think it applies on so many fronts to issues that were brought up during the campaign about the economy, about immigration.
Yeah, the work that I do is really at the intersection of labor and food. And what we do is we help under recognized talent get good jobs in the culinary industry, and it's women, and it's a lot of immigrant women, and it's a lot of women who have varying levels of education. We provide a pretty intensive job training program, and then we place them with high road employers around New York City. And the other thing that we do is we run a small business incubator, and so we have 75 food businesses that are trying to kind of get off the ground out of our space in East Harlem. And our programs really serve New York. And, you know, when I think about Solace, you know, most days I'm excited to go to work because it's a pretty cool place to work. And we have women from around the world. And this year we had a lot of first-time voters, so new citizens that you know, and generally it's really interesting to come, and there's always good food and good bread. But yesterday I was so grateful that that Hot Bread Kitchen is my employer and where I put my work in. And I think many of us in New York City and many of us that work in food felt that way yesterday, right? Like, this, we are the people, those of us that are making the food and coming into work yesterday and realizing that, like, it's, we're going to go on, and that these women that we work with will continue to, you know, be a solidarity of women and taking care of their families and moving forth with their careers is, you know, the only way that I could think to move forward.
Yeah, I agree. Yesterday, I spent most of the day at the bakery, and it was the only place I'd rather be than home with my family. It was, you know, a bunch of women gathered around. We all were having the same complicated feelings, and customers coming in, and we were all crying together. And it was just like kind of a really special day. It's actually quite busy.
Marion, what's the mood at NYU?
Well, I think it's very similar. All of us feel that we're involved in very important work to make the world a better place. And many of us were talking yesterday about our focus on students and how important it is to work with students to try to keep their optimism up and to get them working on positive forward activities that are going to make life better for everybody. And there's still plenty of room in our society to do that. And universities are havens for nurturing that kind of effort. All of us feel like we're doing work that is valuable to us personally, but is also valuable to the community at large, and we feel very deeply about it. And so I think there's been a lot of, I mean, I'm so happy to hear everybody else is saying exactly the same thing, because I think this is the only way we're going to get through this.
And when government fails, it's the work of civil society to stand up in its absence and redirect the democracy. And so that, I think, is the important work that we're all in, that we're engaging in.
I'm so angry, though, that the Republicans have been rewarded for their bad behavior over the past 8 years.
Especially, yeah, go ahead.
No, I mean, you know where I'm headed with that. You know, they stymied the president at every turn, and things weren't great for a lot of people in this country. And I don't blame Barack Obama, and I don't blame Hillary Clinton. I blame the Republicans.
Well, the worst part of this, too, is, I mean, actually, I'm not sure what's worse. I don't know if it's worse that Donald Trump is our president or that we have a majority now. And so executive office, Republican, Congress, completely Republican across the board, which then means that there's an opportunity for the Supreme Court to be loaded with conservative judges, which is, in a way, because we're women, one of the more terrifying things I think that we can all imagine, just from the point of view of reproductive rights and health. I mean, it's terrifying. It's like you keep going from one. It's sort of like if you guys have ever stubbed like two toes, and one hurts so much, it kind of goes numb, and then you remember the other one hurts. It's Trump, but then this.
Then the Supreme Court. Trump, Supreme Court.
Yeah. It's a big stew.
I mean, the thing that kills me is the first thing they want to do is repeal the Affordable Care Act.
Astonishing.
If you care so much about, Jessamine, what you were talking about, you know, the people in the Rust Belt and all these people who are suffering and who've been left behind in this new economy, your first thing that you do is repeal something that's brought insurance to 20 million people, that makes sure that you can have insurance if you have existing illnesses or what
diseases. And that kills small business owners, right? From a business perspective, and I'm sure Aaron can speak to this. I mean, it's so complicated, and we put in so much effort, and we went on the, our employees were part of the small business group that takes, I can't remember what it's called, takes advantage of the Affordable Care Act, and took so much effort to get there, and to now hear that this is, you know, all of that work, even if it's not working perfectly, but the kind of short-termedness of the commitments that are made during the campaign season are really what gets you scared. Mm-hmm. Not even to mention the wall.
The wall.
I think that's kind of hilarious, though.
We're going to skip the wall. We're going to lose Marion in a little bit. So, Marion, we do have some questions from Instagram for you. Katie Zanville posted, "I would love to hear from Marion about the future of food policy with a Republican-controlled Congress and what can happen with Michelle Obama's progress on childhood nutrition."
Well, I don't have a crystal ball. And not only do I not have a crystal ball, but I'm a skeptic of election campaigns. In my experience, candidates lie. I'm willing to put money on betting that Trump raises taxes, for example. And because that's what Republicans do. When Ronald Reagan was running for governor in California and for president, he promised to reduce taxes, and the minute he got in, he raised them. So I don't believe anything that any of them say. And it's very hard to know what is going to happen. And if you're a pessimist, you think the world is coming to an end. If you're an optimist, you hope that he's going to turn out to be a much more tempered kind of individual than he appeared to be when he was running for office. But we don't know. And I'm just waiting to see what happens. And I don't like to, I'm generally an optimistic person, and I just hate the idea of looking at what could happen. And I happened to go to the opening of the so-called permanent structure for Michelle Obama's organic garden at the White House. And part of that effort was to try to make that garden a permanent part of the White House grounds. And to me, the most horrible symbol of what is about to happen would be tearing that up.
Oh, you know,
As one of my friends said, he'll put a golf course there.
Oh, yeah.
Crushing.
The White House golf course. You know, it's so interesting because I was about to say, like, well, I feel like kids and food and anti-obesity are, it's like a safe policy issue that's kind of bipartisan and everybody loves feeding kids. And then I just thought about the fat bashing that he has been publicly doing. And I'm like, you know what? Like, who knows what he's going to do to those programs? There's so much hate in that direction.
Isn't Melania's campaign anti-bullying so that every time Trump bullies her, I guess she can
she can
call on her cause.
She'll know.
This is painful.
You never know what goes on in a marriage.
No. Okay, Marion, next question. Jessica Hulse Dillon asked about food safety and labeling issues. What do you expect will happen?
Well, again, I don't know.
We need you to have a crystal ball.
Please give us more information.
The whole thing will get dismantled. And that the rules that have not yet completely come out will be completely overturned. And certainly food safety is a huge issue because companies have to produce food safely. And if they don't, the FDA can come after him. And Trump was on record as saying that he thinks you ought to get rid of the FDA.
Oh, gosh, I didn't know that.
The food police. You should get rid of the food police.
Yes.
That's a
hand
terrifying
healthcare?
Thought.
Scary.
Will he actually do that? I don't know.
I didn't know that about the getting rid of the food police.
You didn't hear about the food police?
No.
Isn't it part of, like, his budget cut?
That was one of the comments. The food police is the FDA, and they have enough trouble. They haven't been adequately funded in decades. And to have a president come in who thinks that regulation is inconvenient for industry would be not a good thing. But we don't know what he's going to do.
Marion, do you have a wish list?
Oh, I have a wish list for strengthening the kinds of things that were set up during the Obama administration. I want to see more money for school lunch and school meals, a lot more money for school meals. I want to see more money for food safety, more money for inspections, and much better education from the federal government. Will we get that? Well, I'm not optimistic about that.
You know, this brings us to the next question from Stephanie Neville. She wants to know, during a time when it seems unlikely that the government will support our interests, what companies and organizations should we support? And she goes on to say, to continue the work of Michelle Obama and others to increase healthy, sustainable food. But who should we be supporting right now? What should we be supporting right now?
Well, I certainly think there are plenty of organizations that are doing absolutely magnificent work, some of them represented on this telephone on this particular program. And I think you pick your issue and decide. I mean, this election showed that local initiatives can be really powerful. soda tax is passed in four cities in the United States. None of the ones that were proposed failed. That's grassroots organizing at a local level, and it may not seem to you that soda taxes are the most important issue in the world, but it shows that if communities get behind an issue, they can make it happen, even in an election that elects Donald Trump. So that, to me, is a beacon of hope and a and a roadmap for what we need to be doing. We need to be organizing around issues that matter to us. And there are lots and lots of organizations at the local level, at the national level. Center for Science and the Public Interest works on consumer education issues and has been for 45 years and does a really good job of it and has staff in place who are paid to do that, a very important organization for that reason. Food Policy Action is another organization, a newer one. That's the one that Tom Colicchio is behind, and they are trying to hold members of Congress accountable. That's going to be a big job this year. But I'm all for working at the local level. I think you can make a huge difference in schools, in consumer education, even in food safety and the kinds of cities that you live in, if you organize around those issues. And those will be really helpful for people, especially if they cut SNAP.
Great. Well, thank you, Marion. You know, I have to say, we might not have Hillary Clinton, but I'm glad we have Marion Nestle.
And that's awfully nice.
I think all of us look to you for leadership
Absolutely.
And information, and we really appreciate your activism. So thank you. All right, take care of those students for us.
Well, thanks very much, and thanks for having me on.
All right, thank you for your time, Marion. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
We are going to take a break for a word from our sponsor, Knopf, and then we'll be back for more post-election talk with our panel. Imagine the culinary world without the influence of Julia Child, Marcella Hazan, Edna Lewis, Maher Joffrey, Lydia Bastianich, and Judith Jones. It's impossible. We have the iconic publishing house, Knopf, to thank for bringing the writings and the recipes of these women to life. Knopf's great tradition of supporting new voices continues today with Smitten Kitchen's Deb Perlman, Sweet Bitter's Stephanie Dandler, and Butter Baked Good's Rosie Dakin. Check out Knopf's great collection of fiction, nonfiction, and cookbooks at your favorite bookstore. Keep reading and keep cooking with Knopf. Hi, everybody. Welcome back to Radio Cherry Bomb. This is our post-election, I don't want to call it special, because it is special to have the three of you in the studio, but there's nothing special about not having Hillary Clinton in the White House. We, as I mentioned earlier, this was not the show we expected to do. We actually had taped another show previously that was going to run today, and I just thought, we can't run that show. I mean, we have to talk about what happened. Charlotte, I want to go back to what we were talking about earlier about the sexism part in particular. And you wrote a really important book about women chefs and sexism in the industry, which happened to be a very big influence on Cherry Bomb. And I know it was a big influence on a lot of other people in the industry. I really think, and Jessamine, all respect to the economic issue, but I just think people couldn't handle a woman in the White House. Mm-hmm. Maybe it breaks my heart, but maybe the fact that we got a major party nominee was the progress here. And we can't focus on the fact that she lost. We should focus on the fact that we finally had a woman who was on a ticket.
No, but I think we do need to look at what happened, because I think, is it the exit polls showing that 50% of white women voted for Donald Trump?
I don't get
so,
that.
I mean, that's a reality, and that's beyond sexism when we imagine it as just men sitting around saying, I don't want a lady to be in charge of this country, or I don't think she looks presidential, or whatever that conversation is, or locker room chat, if you will. But it's women who are saying that they would rather see someone else in office.
Not just someone else. Someone else who kind of hates women.
Who hates women. And I had a really interesting conversation with my closest friend from childhood whose mother was the president of Planned Parenthood. When we were growing up, her name's Faye Waddleton, and she was the youngest president of Planned Parenthood and the first African-American woman to be the head of it. And she said a number of years ago, which I totally forgot because I didn't want to remember this, that the election would come down to gender and race, and that people's racism, women's own racism, to some extent would trump their, no pun intended, their feelings about being a woman, and that, yes, a lot of people voted for Trump because he represented the anti-Obama, and that there are enough women in the world, this is according to her, and that, I don't know, I mean, it's a very drastic way of looking at it, but she predicted Trump would win, and she was right, she said.
Faye did?
Yeah, Faye did. She said a lot of women would rather sort of stick it to Obama and everyone who voted for him than worry about things like their reproductive rights. And I think that that is such a startling and upsetting reality, and it, you know, it goes deeper than restaurants and the way that women are treated in restaurants, but it's also all part of the same. And so to me, I'm not sure how you come back from that, and I'm not sure the kinds of conversations that women need to be having with each other about what we can do about that, but we need to reach out to each other, because that should not be happening. White women should not, 50% of us, be not voting for Hillary Clinton just because of whatever other stuff is going on in our heads that has nothing to do with who the better candidate is.
And I think I'm not downplaying the sexism or the racism in this country and how deeply that affects, you know, our electoral system. I think I think that the indication or the thing that was sickening to me was the discourse and the way that Hillary was spoken about throughout the election. I think my point is that I don't think Bernie would have won. I think that the election came down to decision making on people that probably weren't inherently racist or weren't inherently sexist, but were so disenfranchised from the political system that it was never going to be that. But do I hate that my daughter observed an election for a year, even though she's a preschooler, where the way that they talked about the candidate was completely undermined by her gender, and that played such an important role, suggests to me that the sexism that I think we all know, that's why we're here, is inherent in what we're doing, and that is the piece that leaves me cold.
Yeah, we have to talk about the children issue, because that, for me, was possibly the most heartbreaking of this whole thing. How many young children who I can't believe even understood what was going on reacted to this campaign. And Jessamine, you have your daughter, you mentioned, and Erin, you're a mom. Can you talk to us about that?
Yeah, it's embarrassing. And they got it super young. You know, I've got a 5.5-year-old, and I have a just 3-year-old. And like, they clued into it so quickly. And my daughter, I couldn't even face my kids on Wednesday morning. And so I made my husband get up with the kids, and I just took a long shower and cried. And my daughter opened the bathroom door, and she said, "Mom, I'm sad for two reasons." She said, "I'm sad because Hillary lost," because they get win-lose very quickly. And then she said, "And I'm sad because we're moving to Toronto," which is where I'm from. So like any of the other she got, you know, I never told her expressly that we were moving if Trump won. But it just suggests to me that all of the other stuff that we did say, and of course we talked about sexism and his misogyny in front of the kids, assuming they weren't getting it, but they got it. She got all of it. And I was embarrassed. I'm like, I didn't know how to explain it to her, other than to say that sometimes we win and sometimes we lose.
Yeah. My kids were, you know, I have a 4-year-old and a 2-year-old, so she had no idea. I was, you know, definitely crying on the subway to daycare, and all the parents were like, all the mothers were just like, you know, dead in the face, you know, walking in. And for me, it's the future conversation. What am I going to say about why this happened, how it happened. You know, I don't want to be Pollyanna. I am always trying to look at, for the positive in the future, but I think the opportunity here is like creating like how we changed the conversation. Like, yeah, it started here, but look at what we freaking did. Like, look how we changed it up. We went to work. Look at what I, you know, I was involved in this. Your aunt did this. Like, we were marching on the streets. You know, you see, that's what they need to see. And I don't think that they should be protected from the realities of the world. They need to, you know, see it and then see what we do in response to it and see what, so that they can find that in themselves as they grow up.
And maybe the answer is, it's like, we've been here before. In fact, it's been way worse.
Yes.
And we've gotten stronger because of it. And that's what I feel like I need to remind myself.
You can also have conversations about what it is to be a leader and what it is to be a good leader. And I think you can be honest about saying that you don't like the outcome and that maybe this person doesn't represent one. And I think to go back to the beginning of this, with the one of the things that really made me feel so awful about this too, is that how else should Hillary have behaved? Like, I kept going over in my mind, could she have been more composed at debates? You know, if the argument is going to be that women are irrational and we are easily moved and riled up, and she was just cool as a cucumber, right? So what should she have done then, right? I mean, Trump acted kind of like a crazy person, right? And everyone was totally fine with
if
that.
If she was acting the way that he was acting, exactly. I mean, she wouldn't even have gotten to where she was.
I'm frustrated because I think, you know, if you're talking to kids about how you should behave and how women need to put themselves out there in the world, I think that Hillary Clinton did everything that we probably would have told ourselves we should do, right? And that didn't work. And so for me, it's like, how do you use that to have a conversation? Because that was the most negative part of it, which is sort of what you were saying, Jessamine. And I mean, she literally deadened every single thing inside her that could have been called female in a derogative way. And still, she could not get a pass. You know, it just...
Yeah. It's an awful message, you know, that the more qualified person didn't win and mm-hmm. that the person who was a vile bully did win.
He's never held office ever, you guys.
You know, that part doesn't bother me as much as everything else. I could, you know, like when Michael Bloomberg ran for mayor, I thought he was a terrific mayor for three terms.
True. Me too.
You know, I think business people can, I think you can go into careers that you don't have experience in. President is maybe a big one to go into when you don't have that experience.
That's so funny.
Last night it occurred to me, I was like, he never released his tax returns.
No.
I cannot believe that he just snaked around that. Mm-hmm. That when I thought of that last night, I like, you're like, that was like another toe that I hadn't stubbed yet. And I was just like, oh.
And then he used it as a selling point. He was like, that's right. I didn't pay my taxes and you can do that too.
Crazy.
And now he needs to have the rest of the country really pay their taxes. So
right. He has to try to hold people accountable so that his salary gets paid.
Right.
And you know he's going to take his whole salary. Ugh. It's crazy.
You know, Aaron, you talked about Wednesday morning about people walking around with dead faces. I still feel like I'm in this weird zombie apocalypse science fiction movie where I don't know who's on which side.
Yeah, exactly.
You can't assume that people were on Hillary's side. And I think you read a lot about this bubble that people lived in, and I fully acknowledge now that I lived in a bubble, and I just thought you're on the side of what's right and what's good, or you're not. So I actually bought a bunch of Hillary pins during the campaign. I found the biggest one I have, and I put it on my bag, and I'm going to leave it on my bag forever, because I feel like we need to communicate silently to other people on the subway.
I love that.
People on the street. And, you know, how do you know? It is like a weird science fiction movie. It's like one of the, you know, like that Clive Owen Children of Men or whatever, where it's kind of present, but not, and you just don't know.
God. And you've been raised not to bring up politics. I don't know. I think like most of us
growing up,
sort of not. I mean, that within your own family and within your group that you could have those conversations, but not like that you would ask strangers about their political, you know what I mean, their political points of view. So there really is that strange barrier where you're not sure and you want to ask, but you kind of also feel like that's not your business and it's a secret ballot for a reason. And I'm having the feeling of, as a member of the media who writes, I just feel like it really, I always thought it was my job, but it seems that the food media as a whole strayed from this for a while. We really should be writing about the things that make people wake up and make that clear, make it clear what we believe, why we believe it, why things happen. I mean, I don't think that we should be doing any more of these listicles about where to get the best pizza. And I thought it before, but in the last few days, I just think we are feeding into that bubble. We're actually creating a bubble where everyone's just super comfortable reading about burgers all the time. We should have been having some really important conversations. And I just feel very strongly about that now.
It was funny Wednesday morning, funny, not funny, seeing who had probably pre-planned their social media for the week. And all, I was like, I don't really want to read about your granola or whatnot. I want substantial things.
Yeah.
And, you know, Clancy Cooks on Instagram, a lot of you know Clancy, she asked, will food magazines get more political? And I hate to say it, but I think the answer is no.
No, and it kills me. And I've decided that one of the things that I can do, maybe in a small way, and that other food writers can do, is we can say no. We can say we cannot pitch those stories. We can say we are not going to write those stories. I know there are other people who will do it, and that's fine. But I think that we should stand up to that. I think it's completely unnecessary, especially for those of us who are trained as journalists and know better.
I can see not wanting to take sides. Yeah. If you are a food magazine, but you can't, there are other things you can write about.
Mm-hmm.
You can write about Jessamine's organization. You can write about food policy issues. You can write more about farms. You know, you don't have to necessarily choose Democrat or Republican, but you should.
You should be giving voice to people who do not have a voice. That is what you should be doing.
And stop writing about the same damn people over and over again.
The same people are things that just don't have any substance aside from what kind of cheese they put in the sandwich.
And most star chefs, business owners I know don't want to tell their story anymore. I mean, Aaron, I don't know how you feel about this, but I feel like most restaurateurs, I shouldn't say most women restaurateurs are like, well, let's figure out interesting ways to tell the stories of the people that work with me and that make this place happen. I think, you know, with some creativity on the part of the journalist, and I mean, Cherry Bomb obviously does an amazing job of it. It doesn't just have to be about those personalities. And I think that what people want are human stories. And the easiest human to get behind any food brand is the owner or the star chef talent. But in talking to, you know, everybody feels the same sense of pride about the guy or the gal that started out washing pots, who's now creating your lunch specials, or the way that we take breads that women have from their home kitchens and we put a spotlight on it. Like, everybody feels proud of those stories, because that's why the work that we do is satisfying, and the media can do a better job of telling that.
And it's also putting those different kinds of breads in the magazine too. I mean, if you do have to be really practical about it, and it does have to be about a recipe or putting a meal together, it's like, okay, then we do not need to see the same turkey on every cover of your Thanksgiving issue. There are other countries in the world that do not celebrate Thanksgiving, and there are a lot of cultures in this country that do Thanksgiving in ways that are completely different and maybe don't even have turkey. So there are ways to do it where, if you aren't going to be overtly political, you can still try and say something a little bit more.
Charlotte, what you're proposing is very radical.
I know.
No Thanksgiving turkey on the November issues.
I will never work in this town again.
Charlotte, you brought up family earlier. Michelle H. on Instagram wants to know how everyone is going to deal with Thanksgiving and family members with different political opinions. Erin, this is a good one for you. You have 11 brothers and sisters.
Right.
I imagine there's a Republican.
Oh,
or two,
yeah. I mean, it is not, you know, harmonious. I usually just, my advice would be to avoid it. I think that something that was really stuck with me was the footage I saw of when the Republican party, where they were watching Trump winning, and then they showed at the Hillary party where everyone was crying, and it made them more excited. And to me, that just really sums up what it's like to argue with someone about something that you feel so differently about. and you're not going to accomplish anything that way. You're just going to fuel it, make them more pissed off, want them to go out harder and show you how wrong you are. So I think unless you are coming from a place of feeling totally like inspired to say something or have something like uplifting to contribute, I just say avoid it, because or else it's just making the other side stronger.
In my hearts of hearts, and like I
hiding in the bathroom to eat is always like something that we would do in my house.
Yeah, but they wouldn't even notice if you were gone.
That's exactly it. That was the only place you could go to get some privacy was the bathroom.
I don't know how you guys feel, but like it gives me a somewhat warmer feeling in my heart to think about the apocalyptic feeling we are having right now would be still had, that there is half the country that would be feeling as apocalyptic as we would if the election had gone the other way. Right. And they're humans and they have families and they're growing our food and they work in food too. And like, I'm curious to see if you guys agree with that, because I do. I keep kind of reminding myself that, and it makes me feel like somehow they live in this country too, and they want positive outcomes for this country too, and that somehow everything is going to have to continue.
I want to think that so badly. It's just that so much of the Trump campaign was fueled by hate, like hate mm-hmm. rallies, hateful speech, and so when I think about their apocalypse or their feelings, it's harder for me because I don't see them feeling frustrated because they feel like they're surrounded by hate. I think if they hadn't gotten their candidate, you know, in office, they would have just been that much more hateful.
If they watch their media, don't they think that we were spewing hate towards them?
But you know what, Jasmine, I totally hear you. I know you're being a little bit of a devil's advocate about that, but I just feel like their vote was a vote to condone hatred.
Me too.
And there was nothing. Donald Trump was dwelling very much in black and white territory. There was nothing gray about the messages coming out. And, you know, I believe firmly you're on the side of the right or you're not.
Me too.
And I don't mean the right as in
the right.
The right. Confusing.
Yeah. I mean, of what's right.
There was a tweet, I think if it wasn't yesterday, it was like the night of the election, from David Duke, you know, of the KKK,
yeah.
about how this was like the greatest day of his life. And it was also, I think, the first time in I don't know how many years that the Ku Klux Klan actively endorsed a candidate. And that, to me,
charming.
I just have such a problem with that no, I can't sit around and think about how there's another half of the country right now who could have been having an apocalypse like ours. I just can't. I want to, but I can't.
It doesn't give you solace.
Okay, we have 12 minutes left. I want us to talk about some positive things. And a lot of the questions that we got were, what can I do moving forward? And I think Marian touched on some great action points, but I want to know from each of you, what are you going to do personally? Who wants to start?
I can start. I'm an avid meditator and have been for over a decade, and so of course I go straight to that. And I was having a really hard time yesterday, I listened to this one of those Oprah Super Soul Sunday things to like try and like shake off this feeling. And Michael Beckwith was on, and he said, ask instead of asking yourself, what can I do? Ask yourself empowering questions like, who can I be right now? And like, what sort of quality is trying to emerge in me? And so in my next meditation, I just said, I put out there like, what can I, you know, how, who can I be in this? And immediately, a few hours later, I was reading, you know, through Instagram or something, and Julia Tershin wrote something about Planned Parenthood and how you should support. And I was like, why am I not going to Planned Parenthood for my women's health issues? Like, why am I not doing that? That's one thing I can do right there. And you know, you'll get signs and ideas of what you can do just naturally. You don't have to really like go forcefully out seeking. It will come to you. It will just like show up. Like somebody in a conversation is going to say something. And you're like, oh, can I come with you? That sounds good. You don't have to be so like think so macro about it, and just be organic and authentic, and you'll attract into you what where you fit in.
Charlotte.
Yeah, similarly, I started thinking about how to be that much more thoughtful about every choice I make, about what I write, what I read, what I choose not to read. I mean, what I choose not to click on. Mm-hmm. I mean, specifically with things like that. What I buy. I mean, I've always thought about that, but I'm thinking now about what restaurants I want to go to, where I want to buy my food, things like that, and just really being sure that I'm craving whatever the cookie is that much, that if it's not a place I actively want to support, maybe I don't need that cookie. Because I think those decisions, they're really small decisions, but it's still, when you make choices about where to spend your money, it's a big deal. And also, yeah, thinking about the causes that matter to me in terms of what I can do as a writer to put them forward, and also how much I can support them monetarily. Those are things I'm thinking about. And there was, I think, a quote circulated on Twitter yesterday. I think it was like a Desmond Tutu quote about this idea that if you are neutral, you are on the side of the oppressor. And so I just thinking very much how to not be neutral, to make sure that I'm speaking up and that I'm actually making those choices as small as they are.
So it's such a good question. It's such a big question. And that's why when at 9 a.m. you emailed me yesterday and asked if I would talk on these issues, I was so grateful to have something I could do today and tomorrow, because I feel incredibly disempowered. And I think the guilt of did I do enough in the election cycle is heavy, you know. Listen, I've dedicated my professional life to growing an organization that feels so much more relevant today, even than it did 3 days ago, right? That advocating and fighting for women's rights is what I do, and I'm really happy that I can do that. But how can I make that vehicle more powerful? And so we were and we are thinking about, you know, we have been planning to for national expansion, but like, goddamn, like I'm going to get on that, and I'm going to go into some of those red states, and now there's a lot of them, and do it faster and do it more effectively and do it for women that need it the most. And that feels really important right now. And I think on a micro level, like I internally, like at Hot Bread Kitchen, I don't take a visible political stance. And it's crazy because what I do is so political, but I don't write op-eds. I don't comment on immigration policy. We're a sales-driven nonprofit that also fundraises. And so I have to toe a careful line, right? Because you never want to offend a customer. You never want to offend a donor. And listen, nobody's knowingly donating to Hot Bread Kitchen if they're kind of on the fence on these issues. But it is a line that I toe. And even internally, I reminded everyone to get out to vote. But I didn't push a political candidate. And my heart broke yesterday when I heard that one of the bakers with limited English proficiency had understood the go home immigrant message in the wrong way and had cast a vote for Trump. That we hadn't, you know, we hadn't advocated, we hadn't provided translated material. And so it makes me think, like, I think I need to get more in an internal advocacy role around political issues and put more of our social capital and translate it into stronger political capital.
So, Jessamine, I want to talk a little bit more about the three of you, because I'm really happy that you were able to be on the show today. Hot Bread Kitchen also has a retail line, which you can buy in Whole Foods. You're in several of the farmers markets, in the New York City green markets.
We've got a great online store, so people can buy it and we can ship it overnight. Great holiday gifts. Good thing to give your teachers if you've got kids in school.
And you've also got all the graduates of your incubator program. We had Hawa Hassan.
Awesome. She's great.
Her what's the name of her line again? We have to look it up. Maybe Annabelle, our interns in the studio. You can look. Oh, Boss Boss. That's the name of it. Boss Boss Sauce.
Spicy
you can go
sauce,
to their website.
Great.
Their cilantro sauce is so amazing.
Delicious.
Do you have a list of them on your website?
Yeah.
So you can.
Yeah, we incubate, you know, and what I was going to say when Marion was listing great organizations, supporting your local farmers market and supporting food businesses is really important. So we have 75 small food businesses. Most of them are women owned, and I encourage people to go and shop from them.
And then Charlotte has a brand new cookbook that she keeps forgetting to promote, but
really
that was the whole point of having her here originally.
In light of this conversation.
Charlotte was originally booked to be on the show to talk about her cookbook. So we do need to give you some time to talk about your cookbook. It's okay, Charlotte. We all want to support you. What's the name of the cookbook?
It's called Stir, Sizzle, Bake, and it is about baking in cast iron. It also really teaches you how to bake and to use a lot of unexpected ingredients and flavors, and you'll learn about other cuisines in a sort of goofy, spirited way. Also like to point out cast iron skillets, really good weapons. So if you're not feeling right now like you want to bake and you need to take to the streets, take
that's
your skillet
next
with
book.
You. Exactly.
And then we have Erin McKenna, who has Erin McKenna's Bakeries in New York, LA, and Orlando. And it is one of my happy places. When I'm having a rough day, I go get one of those brownie cupcakes with mint frosting.
And frosting shots.
Your tea's always so good to me.
Thank you.
You can also, do you have mail order?
Yeah, you can order online. We ship, and we are doing pumpkin pies and stuff for Thanksgiving that are vegan and gluten-free and taste good.
Another wonderful small business to support. I'm a big fan of voting with your dollars, like Charlotte
said,
and like everyone referred to. You know, there are so many good things you can support with your money, and that's just one way.
And you can support Cherry Bomb because there's a new issue coming out, right?
There is a new issue of Cherry Bomb.
Good.
You can pre-order it right now. Absolutely. Thank you, Charlotte. So sadly, that's it for today's show. I know two of you came here very last minute, so thank you so much. And Charlotte, good luck with the cookbook. We hope you sell lots of copies.
Thanks.
That's it for today's show. For those of you who are really mourning what happened Tuesday night, know that you're not alone. As we said, it's clearly time to take action. Get involved in local and national organizations that mesh with your principles. Spend your money on brands that have a conscience and speak up. Thanks, as always, to our engineer, Dave Tadashore, and much love to Knopf for supporting this season of Radio Cherry Bomb and for publishing such beautiful books like the works of Julia Child. Don't forget to support Heritage Radio, the not-for-profit home of Radio Cherry Bomb. To make a donation, visit heritageradionetwork.org. Thank you for listening, everyone. You are the bomb. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.